They keep you pretty busy. While I was there, Jamie came to visit. Bob Timmons brought Chris Farley in to see me, and it felt good to have his support. Kim Jones brought her two beautiful sons to see me. I was allowed a boombox, and I kept playing the first Alaska tape over and over again. I graduated from my 30-day program and went back out and rejoined the world of the living. Thank God I was in that world when Jamie's dad left it. He died in June, and I was able to go out to Pennsylvania and be with Jamie and her family through this difficult period. That summer, the band put the finishing touches on the record and began to shoot the videos. We were getting tons of reels, but nothing was touching us, so we went back to Gavin Bowden, Flea's brother-in-law. He came up with an idea for Warped, which would take place in a giant wooden cylinder. It was a 2-day shoot and was our most expensive video of today. I still think it had elements of greatness. The element that drew the most attention in that video was a scene in which Dave kissed me. Flea and Dave and I were supposed to come out from behind a wall and do a mysterious silhouetted shadow dance thing. We shot the same scene about 10 times in a row, and Gavin felt that we hadn't gotten it, so we went back to our places to try it again. Dave turned to me and said, "This time when we walk out, I'm going to turn around and give you a kiss to spice it up." I said, "Okay, good idea," thinking that he would give me a friendly smooch. We walked out from behind that corner, and he went to give me what I thought would be a peck on the lips, which is already crazy enough for a rock video. But all of a sudden, Dave started giving me a wet, partially open-mouthed, full-blown kiss. I wasn't upset or bothered, just surprised. That was one of 1,000 shots we did, and we moved on. Weeks later, we got the edited video, and there was the kiss, prominently featured. Minutes later, I got a call from Eric Greenspan, our lawyer. "Warner Brothers saw the video, and they want to get rid of the kiss right away," he said. "Why?" "They don't think it's marketable," he said. "And I think you might want to get rid of the kiss, too. I think you're in danger of alienating a large segment of your fan base." When I saw the kiss, I was thinking I could take it or leave it. But the minute the corporate suit started saying, "No kiss," was the minute I started saying, "Nope, the kiss stays." We had a band discussion and voted to keep the kiss. We did have a huge backlash from the college frat boy segment of our audience. We got letters denouncing us as fags, and rumors started spreading, and we started to second-guess our decision. But then we figured, fuck it. Maybe it was time to thin out the yokels anyway. If they couldn't accept what we were doing, we didn't need them anymore. We got in trouble with Warner's again when we used Gavin for our aeroplane video. He came up with a super treatment, an expansive ode to Busby Berkeley, featuring a huge chorus line of half-naked, hot-costumed Mexican cholitas, tough gangster girls with heavy makeup and sweeping hair. We wanted lots of semi-nudity and sexy dancing and chewing of gum and blowing of bubbles. We shot the video in an old pool with trapeze artists and underwater ballet teams on a vintage MGM set that was about to be demolished. But a lady from Warner's was supervising the shoot, and it turned out that she was a PC feminist. Gavin did the edit, and the video looked sumptuous. He captured the hot Mexican girls in close-ups and from wonderful angles, but this woman from Warner's got her knickers all in a knot about showing naked women in our video. Mind you, this would be tame today next to a Jay-Z video, but it was pretty strong for the time, so we were forced to end up somewhere in between our take and her aesthetic. We wound up not using the shots that were truly shocking and beautiful and eye-catching and disturbing all at the same time. That summer, I made the first of 2 open-sea kayaking trips to Alaska with Flea and our ex-drummer Cliff Martinez and our friend Marty Goldberg. We spent about a week kayaking into the deepest fjords of southern Alaska. It was an amazing trip, especially since both Cliff and Marty were gourmet chefs who were able to whip up 3-star meals in the middle of the wilderness. In September, One Hot Minute was released. We were proud of it, even if it wasn't as good a record as we could have made if we'd kept the band together after Blood Sugar. But for a brand new band, it was a pretty good effort, along the lines of, say, Mother's Milk, the first album we made with John and Chad. Before we began touring, I was set to do some interviews to promote the album. Right about then, I started getting loaded again. I was holed up in my house on an absolute terror one day in September, and the phone wouldn't stop ringing. I finally answered it, and it was Louie.
"Dude, MTV is outside your house. They're ready to shoot."
I remembered that I was supposed to do an MTV shoot at my house with the VJ Kennedy. I dragged myself downstairs. I looked sick and lifeless, and I had to answer all these questions on camera in my living room from the bubbly, sweet Kennedy. It's been a while since you had a record, blah, blah, blah. What a disaster. Now it was time to tour. Even though I'd been on a run beforehand, I never considered using on the road. I knew that would destroy everything overnight. We started in Europe. It was the first time we'd played before audiences since Woodstock, so we were like a car engine in need of a tune-up. I felt some responsibility for not allowing us to be as good as we could have been. I wasn't as focused on my musicianship as I should have been. We weren't bad, and there were some excellent moments, but overall I was feeling lackluster, and as a musician, I was experiencing a slightly broken reed. The most memorable thing about the European tour was meeting Sherry Rogers, who would go on to become the wife of our road manager, Louis Mathieu, and the mother of his children. We met her in Amsterdam, where she was working for our old pal Hank Schiffenmacher. Whenever we passed through Amsterdam, we made a beeline to get some more tattoos from Hanky Panky, and this trip we encountered a hot, lovely, full-of-spunk young lady named Sherry. She'd routinely dress up in a Rubbermaid's outfit, and the thought of having her come on stage in that getup was appealing. Our next gig was in Belgium, and she came along and blew everyone's mind when she took off all her clothes in front of everyone in the dressing room and donned the rubber costume. During the show, we had her come on stage periodically to wipe the sweat off our brows, serve us beverages, and light Dave's cigarettes. Our U.S. tour, which was supposed to start in mid-November, got postponed, through no fault of mine, for once, until the beginning of February. So I went straight from Barcelona, our last gig in Europe, to New York to be with Jamie. Jamie had left her dingy high-rise in Chinatown and moved into a charming, cozy, deluxe apartment overlooking the statue of LaGuardia just south of Washington Square Park. It was a tranquil, gorgeous neighborhood. We had a nice autumn there. And then, as usual, we began early preparations for the annual Christmas trips. That was when I got the first inklings that all wasn't well on the domestic front. Christmas shopping started out well enough. We walked through the snow and enjoyed the pre-Christmas romance of buying nice presents for our family. I decided to buy Blackie some furniture for his house, so we went to ABC Carpet on Lower Broadway and picked out a nice selection. I went back to the store a couple times to arrange the shipping and delivery, and one time I was there alone, standing near the elevator, when this elegantly dressed woman in her 20s walked in. She was beautiful and stylish, and I had a one-minute conversation with her while she was waiting for the elevator. This voice went off in my head. You could marry this lady. Your wife is about to get in that elevator and disappear forever, so you might want to act on it right now. Just at that moment, the elevator came, and she got in and was whisked from my life forever. That was the first time while I'd been with Jamie that I'd been open to that kind of idea. I couldn't tell if I was giving power to the fantasy, or if there was a look in her eye, or something in the way she carried herself, but it was a distinct foreshadowing of trouble. Come Christmas, we made the usual trips. That year, I gave my mom her first deluxe auto, a brand new customized Ford Explorer that a Western Michigan car dealer had specially painted and modified and tricked out for his wife before she divorced him. Blackie did all the research and development on that present. Then Jamie and I spent a few days in Pennsylvania to say hello to everybody, but with the recent loss of Jamie's dad, it obviously wasn't a very joyful time. We returned to New York in time for New Year's. I was so fed up with the commercialism of New Year's Eve and the compulsion on everyone's part to have the best night of their lives that I decided we would go to sleep before midnight. We cuddled together on the couch and watched a movie, and about 11:30 we turned off the lights and went to sleep. A few days after that, I got the epiphany that this period of my life had come to an end and that it was time to be single again, to be alone. I looked at Jamie one day and thought, I'm not in love with her anymore, for no reason. It was nothing she did. It wasn't the way she talked or the way she walked or the things she said, because she never did anything that I found intolerable. Something just dawned on me. It was as if a fog had lifted. I was like, Jesus Christ, what have I been doing for the last 2 years? It's time to make some changes. But it was all about being sober. I had no intention of getting high. I had probably done enough damage to myself that I was incapable of being in love with her. And that voice was so clear to me that to have ignored it would have meant faking my feelings from that point forward. I knew that I had to do the most undesirable thing of all. For me, it was much easier to stay in an uncomfortable relationship than to tell somebody, I'm leaving. Historically speaking, I was terrible at it. I couldn't say, I don't want to be with you anymore. I'd rather go hurt myself, which is part of my cycles. I told Jamie, and she didn't accept it. She told me that she was planning on getting married to me and having kids, which was the saddest thing she said during all of our discussions. There was a lot of crying and ranting, and then she packed up her stuff and got back on the red eye and left. Because I had caused somebody whom I truly cared about so much pain, it was the perfect emotional setup to go out on another binge. It started on a Friday afternoon. I drove my motorcycle down to Lindy's for a band business meeting. On my way there, I stopped downtown and filled up my pockets with drugs. Then Flea and Lindy and I had our meeting, and I left Lindy's house in the bright daylight, drove a few blocks, and started hitting that pipe right there on the street. The minute the drug hit my brain, I started the bike up and went. I ran for 2 or 3 days, smoking crack and putting the heroin on top of that, and all at once, I was in another desperate predicament. I figured I'd be in too much trouble if I stayed in L.A., so I got out the Yellow Pages and dialed up Aero Mexico. I found the nicest hotel in Cabo San Lucas, a beautiful place where I had worked on songs with Flea a few years earlier. I was so high on heroin that I was a danger to myself, scratching holes in my body, and I certainly couldn't hide my condition from anyone, so I ordered a car to drive me to the airport. I had saved a handful of balloons that I was going to take with me for some weenage. There'd be no trouble getting on board with them, but I was wary of Mexican customs, so I decided to hide the balloons in the cassette area of my CD cassette boombox. When I landed in Mexico, I was still high, and my hair looked like a theremin. The airport had a customs system where you step up to the line, press a button, and get either a red or a green light. If I got a green light, I was home free. Of course, it came up red. I went to the table, and the customs guy was looking at me with great suspicion. He searched my bag and my pockets, and then said, "Let me see the stereo." My heart started racing. The last thing I needed was to get busted bringing heroin into Mexico. He looked inside the battery compartment, which I had considered as a stash place, and then he had trouble trying to operate it. He was hitting all the cassette buttons, just about to hit eject, when he looked at me and said, "Make it work." I clicked it right to CD, pushed play, and the Jackson 5 greatest hits started blasting. He passed me on. I had booked a room at the Westin, a modern hotel that had been designed to look like a red clay Mexican structure. I holed up in the bed, used the last of the heroin, and then cocooned, ordering room service and watching satellite TV and feeling lonely and depressed and remorseful. By the third day of lying in bed, eating, and trying to become human again, I forced myself to go down and jump in the ocean. I had to baptize my spirit. I went to the pool area and tried to swim, but I ran into people who wanted to talk to me, and I wasn't up for that at all. On that trip, I made friends with a pelican whose wing had been damaged in a fisherman's net. He had become the mascot of the pool area. I sat there and fed him and talked to him. We were two creatures nursing our wounds. I even wound up writing a song about that pelican. At some point, I performed the selfish and errant act of calling Jamie, even though I knew in my heart of hearts that our relationship was over. But she was still my best friend and a soothing entity in my life. I'm down here, and I'm lonely, and I'm sick, and I'm tired, and I'm hurt, and I'm fucked up, and I'm sad. Do you want to come down? She flew in the next day, and we had a decent couple of days together, staying in bed and eating and talking. Cabo became my own personal rehab. I'd stay sober for a few weeks, relapse, make a mess of situations, then go back down and check into the same hotel room and do the exact same thing, which is one of the better definitions of insanity, doing the exact same thing over and over and expecting the result to be different. If you had to be sick somewhere, Mexico was the place. I did consider myself fortunate to have the luxury of going down there and lying out under those blue skies. At the beginning of February 1996, we began a 3-leg, 2-month U.S. tour. We were opening the tour at the Nassau Coliseum on Long Island, but the day we got to town, the New York area was hit by an incredible blizzard and was under a monstrous blanket of snow. The subways and the cabs weren't running, so Flea and I took a snowy walk from our Midtown motel to the Lower East Side to eat at Angelica's Kitchen, a great vegetarian restaurant. Later that night, I met Gaio at the Spy Bar in Soho. There were a lot of girls there, but most of them were too New York fabulous and difficult to deal with. Then we saw this girl who was a little tipsy, wearing a bright red dress and some weird 80s zebra belt accoutrement. She was in her own world by the piano, doing a heartfelt pantomime to a Bjork song. I thought that took a lot of chutzpah, so I went over to her and introduced myself. Her name was Christina, and she was a model who had grown up in Idaho but was now living in New York. She had natural orange-red hair and crazy beautiful white skin and huge tits, way too big and pillowy for normal runway modeling. I invited her to the show the next night, and she asked if she could bring her roommate, who, it turned out, was a huge Oasis fan. This was the moment that Oasis was the hottest band going, having permeated every nook and cranny of America. I had purposefully ignored this phenomenon, but on the ride out to the Coliseum, all Christina's roommate could talk about was Oasis and this brother or that brother. We plowed through the snow and got to the Coliseum, and I was relieved to see that the place was full and the audience was appreciative. That night I began seeing Christina, which was a good thing, since it had been a while since I felt that connection with somebody. I wasn't falling in love, but she was a nice person, and we were definitely sexually compatible. I don't know if it was her smell or her energy, but we'd be in bed, and I'd feel like an opiated vampire from being with her. Early on in that tour, I fell off the stage. We were playing these new One Hot Minute songs that hadn't seen too much stage time, and I was in the midst of my eyes-closed robotic dancing when I tripped over one of my monitors. I went plummeting right off the stage and dropped 8 feet, hit my head on the concrete floor, and passed out. I came right to and was grateful to be conscious, but my head was the least of my problems. Before I tripped, my leg had gotten tangled in my mic cord, so when I fell, the cord acted like a hangman's noose and ripped my calf muscle right off the bone. I was hanging upside down, thinking I could deal with the head injury, but when I pushed myself back up on stage, my leg wouldn't work. I finished the show on one leg and went to the hospital. I got some stitches in my head, but my leg had become black and blue and green and wildly disfigured looking. They rigged me up with a frankenfoot-looking cast, complete with a vast array of straps. I had to finish the rest of the tour with this frankenfoot, which was not fun to perform in. After the second leg of the tour, we had a 2-week break. Prior to the tour, Sherry Rogers had moved up to San Francisco and begun a relationship with Louis Mathieu, who had moved up from L.A. to live with her. I used to visit them up there, and we'd go to meetings and haunt the tattoo parlors. I had begun to get close with Louis. Louis was half Mexican, half Jewish, and 100% psychotic. He was crazy on the inside, but he put on this calm exterior. He had started with us answering phones at the Blood Sugar House, and then we took him out on tour as the drum tech, basically creating jobs for him because we liked him so much. Louis had been a pot dealer in high school, and then he got strung out on heroin. He went through years of back-and-forth struggles to get sober, but he had been clean at this point for a lot of years. Louis was kind and giving, and would go out of his way to be there for you, almost to the point where it became a defensive mechanism so he wouldn't have to deal with what was going on in his own life. But he was a great running partner, and we shared the sobriety and a love for music. The last thing Louis was an outdoorsman. When we got the 2-week break, I decided to facilitate a nice experience for Louis and Sherry and take them on a trip to Hawaii, which they couldn't have afforded then. Sherry was adventuresome and gung-ho, but Louis agreed begrudgingly. We rented a house on the sunny side of Maui. Every day, Sherry and I would go out in front of the house, dive into the ocean, and swim a mile out and a mile back. Louis would sit on the beach, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and doing his crossword puzzles, naysaying all of nature's beauty that was surrounding him. At one point on that trip, Louis and I were having lunch at a fancy hotel, and a thought popped into my head. Louis, I hear wedding bells for you in the near future. He confessed that he was feeling the same thing. A few days later, near the end of our stay, I had taken a nap in the middle of the day, and when I woke up, the house seemed deserted. It was odd not to have Louis and Sherry around, and I started going from room to room, calling out, Louis? Sherry? Finally, I cracked open the door to their bedroom to see if they were napping. I saw Louis in full slow jam love mode with Sherry, naked man on top of naked woman. I closed the door right up and felt terrible for walking in on them. 9 months to the day later, their son, Cash, was born, which connected me further to the family. Most kids can't say, oh yeah, Uncle Tony was there when I was conceived. We finished the U.S. tour with the West Coast leg. Considering that we had taken a 4-year record hiatus and that the climate of pop music had changed so drastically, it was nice to see that people were still interested in coming out to see what we would do. We were playing arenas, and it wasn't the every-date-sold-out tour of our career, but we were getting warm receptions to the new material everywhere we went. In Seattle, I flew Christina out for a few days. The band had an off night, and Oasis was playing in town. Their management called up and invited us to the show, but no one wanted to go except Christina. By that point, Oasis was in disarray. The brothers were constantly fighting, and shows were being canceled right and left. But we went, and before the show started, we were backstage, and I met the singer. He introduced himself to me, and I said, "Hello, Ian."
"Nah, Liam."
We went through a whole Ian, Liam, Spinal Tap moment. Then we went out to watch the show. It would have been great, except it was obvious they hated each other. They were dead on the stage. The songs and the singing were good, though. Halfway through the show, Christina had a couple of arena beers and got horny and decided she wanted to give me a blowjob. So we wandered backstage. Most of the doors were locked, but I found one that was open. It was below the stage and opened into the electrical control room for the whole arena. There were all these levers and switches and buttons. So we got on the floor, took off our clothes, and started having sex. It was a nice atmosphere. We could hear the muffled sounds of the band playing above us. But somewhere along the way, we got too frisky and banged into a lever, and all of a sudden, the lights went out. I jumped up and rushed over to the board, convinced that we had cut the sound and lights to the entire arena. I frantically pushed a lever, and the lights came back on. I realized that we had cut off the power only in that room, but we were one lever away from bringing the concert to a grinding halt from having sex beneath the stage. Christina was a lot of fun to be with, and our physical relationship was wonderful, but I wasn't falling in love with her to the point of her being my girlfriend. A few months later, right before we went back to Europe to tour, I told her I couldn't see her anymore. She was pretty upset, but Guy-O was beside himself.
"I can't believe you're walking away from this girl. She's the first girl you've been with in a long time who's totally considerate. She brings you flowers. She loves you. She's beautiful. She's sexy. She's smart.
But when you're not feeling it, you're not feeling it." When I broke up with her, she said, "Ah, that really sucks. I was hoping that this relationship was going to go somewhere, but I understand. At least we had a lot of great sex."
I was like, "That's the spirit."
After the West Coast leg, we had a few weeks off before we set to tour Australia and New Zealand again. We started off in New Zealand, and being back there made me realize that this was where I was going to make my home away from home. Somehow I hooked up with an ex-rugby player who had been a member of the all-black New Zealand rugby team in the 60s, but was now an older, brutish, conniving, absolute shyster of a real estate agent. On a break from our shows, he took me out to look at this 169-acre farmhouse overlooking Kai Parau Bay, which is an hour and 15 minutes northwest of Auckland. We went out on the most gorgeous sunny day. I fell in love with the place, even though Kai Parau Harbor is an incredibly rough body of water where great white sharks go to breed. It's a furiously tidal, raging harbor. My whole thrust of finding a home away from home was to buy a place near a clear, temperate, inviting body of water, one that I could swim in and play underwater. I have no idea why I chose this place, because none of that was there. But the view of the harbor was incredible, a kaleidoscopic, psychedelic patina of colors. And this agent had me all hyped up about an auction for the property, which was going to take place, coincidentally, while I was on tour in Australia.
"This is your one and only chance to get this property. It's going to go quick. There are lots of people interested. I'll have you on the phone, and I'll do the bidding for you. Blah, 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 blah."
I was on the phone from Australia, and he was at the auction.
"It's at $1 million. Going up. Going up. Someone here wants it for 1.7. I was like, "Okay, go to."
The next thing you know, I bought this place for way more than it was worth. When I got back, people started telling me that they weren't even sure there was anyone else bidding. All these Kiwi businessmen were in bed with one another. We finished the 2-week tour cycle, and everyone went home to the U.S. except me. I went back to New Zealand, checked into a bed and breakfast, and went through the process of closing this deal, which cost me about $1 million. I was waiting for the farmer who had sold me the place to take his money and move to the Gold Coast of Australia, where it's always sunny. Meanwhile, I was thinking, why on earth would these farmers leave the most beautiful piece of paradise for the crowded-ass Gold Coast, which is like Miami Beach, only tackier? I soon found out. It turned out that I saw that farmhouse on one of the few days of the year when it didn't rain. 300 days out of the year, that country just poured precipitation. It was cloudy, rainy, chilly, blustery, England on a bad day kind of weather. Eventually, the farmer moved out, and I signed the papers and set up a bank account in Auckland. I got Greer's father to be the caretaker, because people in New Zealand were known to move in and occupy vacant country properties. There was this Wild West mentality out there. Greer's dad was going to check up on the property and make sure no one was squatting or stealing the fixtures. It was time to go home and get ready for our European dates. Before we went to Europe, we played the first ever Tibetan Freedom Fest in San Francisco. It was a great lineup that included Smashing Pumpkins, the Beastie Boys, Foo Fighters, Beck, Bjork, and Rage Against the Machine, but it wasn't a great show for us. We had problems with the sound, but it was for a good cause, so we didn't stress much. There was a party afterward, and I ran into Ione and attempted to make amends for being such a shite boyfriend when we lived together. It was the first amends I had ever attempted, and it was ill-conceived to approach her in that environment, so she had every right to tell me that I was an asshole and that I should fuck off before she walked away. When we got to Europe in late June, everyone was optimistic, partially because I had been staying sober for the tours. There was a distinct feeling of brotherhood among us. The only issue surfacing was the fact that Dave wasn't crazy about playing music for the sake of music, and Flea needed that kind of bond. He missed having someone who'd call him up and say, "Come over to my house and let's play guitars for a while." Dave wasn't that guy. He was like, "Why would I come over and play guitar with you? Do we have to write a song for something?" There was a rift developing. But on the other hand, Dave and Chad were becoming quite close. We started the tour off in Budapest. Everyone raved about Prague, but to me, Budapest was a much more interesting town, more exotic and wild, and more recently detached from the communist hold. In Prague, we performed in a small club. It was packed, and I went to do a flip on stage. I was a little bit out of control and landed on one of the monitors. When I went to stand up, there was no one home. We had to stop the set and wheel me off because I was in such excruciating pain. The next day, I couldn't move. I saw a few practitioners, but no one seemed to be able to diagnose what damage I had wrought upon my back. So they strapped me up in a back brace, and I did the next few shows standing in one spot, almost totally immobilized. I had become totally constipated, and I couldn't even sit up straight. The pain was so intense. In every city we went, I begged our tour manager, Tony Selinger, to find somebody, an osteopath, a chiropractor, a voodoo practitioner, anyone who could help me. I was bedridden until I had to go on stage, and that was when I remembered the advice that Carol Lee Brogue, my Fairfax drama teacher, had given me. She was on Broadway playing Peter Pan when she got a nasty stomach virus, but she strapped on a diaper and squirted out diarrhea the whole performance because, no matter what, the show must go on. We were in Belgium when Tony showed up with a fat, sweaty, boisterous Belgian fellow who bounded through my door speaking Flemish. He was an osteopath. I was thinking, geez, yet another quack who's not going to be able to do anything. He examined me, had me stand and walk around, and then told me to get on the bed. This big bowling ball of a fellow went to work on me. He lifted my leg and put all his weight on it, and pop! My whole back snapped into place in one fell swoop. It was like going from being a broken toy to being a brand new one. It turned out I had dislocated my sacrum. I was revitalized, and we began playing well. France was great, then we went on to England, where we played Wembley. It was the single best show we played with Dave. Guy O was there, and he had taken it upon himself to become my matchmaker. Sometime during the spring, he had gone on a boat party in L.A. and met a girl who lived in London. He assured me that she was just my type, so he beat away all the other guys on the boat and got her number for me. After the Wembley show, he introduced me to this girl named Rachel. He was right. I was immediately attracted to her. I decided to get a hotel room and stick around London, even though everyone else was headed home. The next night, Rachel and I went out to dinner and walked through the park. All of a sudden, we started making out, and it was all going on. We went back to her apartment, made love, and she was wonderful. Everything Gaio promised, and then some. A very special girl. We were in our post-coital glow when she said to me, "I have to tell you that this is so weird, because the very last person I had a sexual relationship with was your ex-girlfriend Ione. And by the way, I like this experience much better." Out of the 3 billion girls in the world, I ended up being with one Ione had also been with. The ironic part of all of this was that when I first met Jamie, she was part of the Beastie Boy world through her trust fund boyfriend. While she was hanging around them, she met Adam and Ione, who were married then. As soon as Adam walked out of the room, Ione went for Jamie with open-mouthed kisses. It turned out that Adam and Ione were leading pretty separate lives by then, but I found it interesting that Ione and I had such similar tastes in women. I stayed with Rachel for a few days, but then it was time to go home. It was also time to go on another drug binge. It was bound to happen sooner or later, because I wasn't taking care of myself. I think the fact that I'd spent all this intimate time with a girl I wasn't going to follow through on triggered this episode. Now I had some time on my hands, and I was home alone in what had become the palace of getting loaded. I did a 2-week run, then I went to Cabo San Lucas to do my routine of sleeping for 3 days, kicking, eating like a fiend, and swimming. Same hotel, same room, same northern exposure on satellite TV. When I came back from Cabo, Louis was there for me, picking me up at the airport and hanging around with me. I was over at his house a few days after I'd gotten back when the phone rang. It was my beloved Aunt Mickey, one of my favorite aunts, the second oldest of 4 sisters on my mother's side. She was hysterical, saying, "Steve died! Steve died!" over and over again. I assumed it was her son, because she had both a son and a grandson named Steve. I asked her which Steve, and she sobbed, "Your mother's Steve." Suddenly, the heart and soul of my entire sense of well-being in Michigan was gone. He was the guy who brought my whole family together and gave us this loving homestead, the thoughtful, caring, hard-working, honest soul trooper of the bunch. He raised Julie and Jenny and the dogs and the cats and the horse, and my mom loved them. They were just so good together. I thought, oh shit, my 51-year-old stepdad had to go have a damn heart attack in the garden at 2 in the afternoon. I thanked God that I wasn't in a motel room somewhere, smoking crack off a tinfoil pipe when I got the news. I was newly clean with an extra launch in my stride. It turned out that I was the only one in a clear state of mind. Everyone else was shattered and stunned and torn up. We had a huge funeral service, and the church was packed to the rafters with half of Grand Rapids to say goodbye to Steve and pay homage to this unique citizen. My family elected me to give the eulogy. It wasn't hard to write about a guy like him. For a kid like me, who had always been watching after his mother, Steve entering the picture was such a huge relief. It was like, okay, now I can go be a boy again and not have to worry about my mom getting screwed over by a convict. It was a remarkable experience to look out at this church filled with hundreds and hundreds of people, all of us riding the same wave of love and gratitude and appreciation for this person. Back in L.A., I was sitting at home one day when I got one of those periodic crazy calls from Lindy. He was in his apartment office in Studio City, smoking his merits and telling me that Molson Beer was offering us $1 million to fly up to the North Pole and do a show for the winners of a contest. They'd also get to use our name and our music to sell the hell out of their beer in Canada for a few months. This wasn't the first time we'd gotten an offer from a big corporation. A year after Under the Bridge, McDonald's came up with a whole campaign to sell hamburgers using that song. They were offering $2 million, but we didn't want our name to be associated with them. The Molson offer was interesting because, one, they wouldn't use our image, and two, it was just a radio campaign in Canada. Basically, our music would get heard many times per day. I guess this was a time in our operation when integrity wasn't as revered as it is now. Plus, we all wanted to go to the North Pole. Molson made the whole thing sound appealing. We'd get private aircraft service to and fro and accommodations. The show was for an audience of 100 people, and we'd be in, out, and get to the end of the earth and see the Aurora Borealis. We weighed the good and the bad and agreed to do it. We flew to Montreal and switched to a larger plane to fly north for 8 hours. We got to the site, and there was only one place to stay, a run-down boot camp barracks-type place called the Norwal, named after the unicorn whale. There was no town, just a handful of native Indians who lived up there full-time. We were there the day before the show, so we did some snowmobiling, and they took us on a small propeller flight tour of the North Pole. We marveled at the beautiful blue and white barren landscape. We were supposed to perform on the deck of a Russian icebreaker, but even though it was September 1st, it was freezing outside, with gusts at 50 knots, so the concert was moved into a warehouse. One thing we pride ourselves on is being professionals. When we play all the fucking way. But there was something about the atmosphere that made it impossible to do a normal rock show, where you go out there and boom, you start getting into your shit. We stepped onto that stage, and I looked at the 100 people who had been flown up, and they all had their funny little clothes on, and their Molsons in their hands, and the whole thing reminded me of a bad office party. I picked up the mic, and the music started, and it was time for me to sing, but I couldn't stop laughing.
The preposterous nature of show business overwhelmed me, and I could not get it together. Eventually, I focused, but between songs, I went back 13 years and broke out some of our old comedy routines and started taking the piss out of people and having fun with the audience. There was at least as much comedic banter as there was music. I don't know how long we played, but I was happy when it was over. We flew home that night and saw the aurora borealis and the otherworldly colors and cloud formations, and it felt like we were on a mission to Mars. When we got back to L.A., I began my own private mission to Mars, a furious round of benders that would consume my next few months. I would go out for a week at a time, and even though the whole idea of using it had become repugnant to me and I wanted to stop, I couldn't, which is a textbook definition of active addiction. All this weird-ass shit would happen to me on my runs. On one of these benders, I ran out of drugs at 4:30 in the morning. At that point in time, I wasn't dialed in to ATM technology. When I needed money, I'd go to a bank and take out a chunk of money on a credit card, or I'd visit an American Express office where I could take out as much as $10,000 at a shot. But now I had no money, no stuff, and was in a frenzy to get high. What I did have was a beautiful white Stratocaster guitar signed by all of the Rolling Stones. Tommy Mottola had given it to me when he was trying to sign the Chili Peppers to Sony Epic. I figured I could go downtown and at least get a couple $100 worth of dope for that guitar. So I went down to those dimly lit back alleys where the men sell their wares, but there was only one guy working the street at that late hour. "What can I get for this?" I asked him, proffering the guitar. He shrugged. "Nothing." "No, no, you don't understand," I pressed. "This guitar is signed by the Rolling Stones."
"Dinero, señor. Dinero," he kept repeating.
He was fresh up and over the border, and he obviously couldn't speak English and didn't give a rat's ass about the Rolling Stones.
"But this is valuable," I protested.
He finally offered me the tiniest amount of heroin I'd ever seen.
"No, more," I begged,
but he indicated it was that or nothing.
I was so desperate that I bartered the signed guitar for some drugs that would get me high for about 10 minutes.
All during these runs, I had the support of Bob Timmons, who was constantly trying to get me to check into Exodus again. I was also getting much love from a newer friend of mine, this wonderful white-haired hippie communist from Venice Beach named Gloria Scott. I first encountered Gloria when she was speaking at a meeting in Hollywood during my first round of sobriety in the late 80s. She said she had been a real-deal drugstore cowboy junkie her whole life, knocking off pharmacies and running scams, but she also talked about the 60s and Allen Ginsberg. By then, she'd been sober for about 10 years. I was thinking, this lady is the coolest person I've ever seen. She's nasty and not trying to be all saccharine, saying stuff like, "Fuck you if you don't like what I'm saying, motherfucker, because I've been there." She said her higher power was Neil Young. Then she said, "I've lived in a one-room bungalow down in Venice since 1967. I was dealing with Jim Morrison before you were crapping in your pants. The only things I have in my house are a poster of Che Guevara, a poster of Neil Young, and a poster of a bunch of Red Hot Chili Peppers with the socks on their dicks." I went up to her after the meeting and told her that I was honored to be on her wall along with Neil. We became fast friends, like Harold and Maude without the romance. When I started going missing in action and becoming more desperate and isolated, I stopped answering my phone. Every now and then I'd check my mail and there'd be a postcard of a Native American warrior. On the back, Gloria would write, "Don't ever give up your fight. You are a warrior, and you will beat this thing that you're up against. I have faith in you. I never forget you. Don't forget your own self." I'd read that in my kitchen and think, there's a person out there who actually believes I can win this battle. Around that time, I had a dream in which I was driving at about 4:30 in the morning, the darkest hour of the night before the sun even thinks about coming up. It was pitch black and raining, and I was going through the intersection of Melrose and San Vicente. The streets were dead, and I was driving fast and furious, screeching around corners, obviously going somewhere in a heated passion. I must have been going to cop drugs, because I was driving like my life depended on it. It was eerie and spooky and dark and rainy, and I was all alone in the car, driving and driving. And then, out of nowhere, a hand came out and whoosh, grabbed onto the steering wheel and started fighting me for control of the car. I looked over to see who the person in the seat next to me was, but he was all slouched down with a hat covering his face, so I couldn't make out the demonic person. We kept driving, and I became terrified of what I was about to see. Then we drove under a streetlight, and the light illuminated the face of the intruder. And it was me. I had this horribly scary grin pasted on my face, and I was holding the wheel, saying, "I gotcha, I gotcha, I gotcha." Near the end of October, I checked into Exodus again, this time resigned to being in there. That day, I got a phone call from Bob Forrest. "How you doing?" he asked. "I feel like a gangster in one of those old cops and robbers movies. I'm gonna have to shoot my way out of this place," I joked. I was teasing him, being a character, acting out a scene, trying to make light of the heavy and fucked up place that I was occupying. Bob said, "Oh, really? That sounds crazy. Are you sure you're all right?" "Yeah, I'm gonna stay here and see what happens." I stayed that night. The next day, I woke up and got the call. And the call was to go out and get high again. So I gathered up my stuff and said goodbye to Nurse Kathy, who was the only sane person in that whole place. Everybody else was doing the rehab shuffle. I walked into the corridor, and the woman who ran that wing of the hospital stepped into the hallway and confronted me. "Where do you think you're going?" she said. "You know what? I'm just not ready to go through rehab right now, so I'm leaving," I said. "You can't leave," she said with finality. "We're not going to let you leave." "Let me see you try and stop me," I said. I took a few steps toward the exit, and she rushed up to me. "No, really, we're locking the doors. We're going to have to put you in your room again," she threatened. "Lock the doors? I'll fucking put my bed through the window and leave when I want to. You've got nothing to say about it, lady." What was she talking about? This wasn't a lockdown facility. I was there voluntarily, and I could leave whenever I felt like it. Or so I thought. "I do have something to say about it this time," she said. I was getting pissed off. I had a serious call in here. I had to go get some money, get a cab, and have it wait while I talked to Flacco on the corner. Then I had to find a motel room. I had a very important agenda. But all that went out the window when she pushed a button. Suddenly, there were some very large USC football lineman-sized fellows coming at me from every angle. They grabbed me like a little rag doll and started carrying me down the hallway. "Hey, what's going on here? Let me go, buddy. I have things to do," I was ranting. But they ignored me and carried me past some electronically locked prison-style doors into a separate unit known as the mental ward. This was it. The lockdown. The no-escaping-you're-in-jail-now-insane-asylum-loony-bin ward. I demanded an explanation. "What the fuck is going on?" "You are now on lockdown. You'll be here for the next 72 hours while we observe you," one of the behemoths said. He may as well have said 72 years. 72 hours was not acceptable to me. If he had said 10 minutes, I could have worked with that. But I had pressing business outside. "Oh, no. No, no, no. Get my lawyer on the phone. I demand to talk to my lawyer," I screamed. "Dude, shut up. Someone's gonna be in here to fill out a form, and you'll get a room, and you can chill," my tormentor said. I scanned the corridor. There was no getting out of here. The place was sealed tight as a drum. But as I stood there in the hallway, I saw a pack of loony birds being led into the facility from a smoking patio with sliding bulletproof glass doors. I looked out into the courtyard and saw an approximately 18-foot-high brick wall with nothing around it. There was no way I could get over that wall unless I had some rappelling equipment. Then I saw a basketball hoop about 8 feet from the wall, and I saw my opening. The goons had left me to wait for the admitting nurse, but just then a doctor walked by. He had the pens in the pocket and the stethoscope, and he was reading a chart. He also had a huge ring of keys dangling from his belt loop. "Excuse me, doctor? I was just outside and I left my cigarettes. Could you let me out to the patio area to get them?" "I'm not authorized to unlock the door. That's the policy here," he mumbled. I know, but if you open that door, I'll go out for a minute in that secured compound and have a quick smoke." I was using every mind control technique I could on this guy, and they worked. He unlocked the door, and I thanked him. The minute he turned around, I shimmied up to the top of that basketball hoop, stood on the backboard above it, leaned my body as far forward as I could, and jumped, just catching my fingers on the edge of the wall. Another inch, and I would have done a faceplant into the wall and cracked my skull. I pulled myself up to the top of the wall and jumped down. I was free. I started boogieing down the sidewalk and got about 2 blocks before I stopped to figure out my next move. There was no one coming after me, so I figured they were happy to get rid of me because I was causing such a stink. Then I looked up and realized that I was right in front of a branch of my bank. What a stroke of luck. I could get some cash and begin my excellent adventure. I never spotted the hospital employee who was in the bank depositing a check, but she was watching me as I marched over to the desk of the branch manager. He looked up.
Anthony Kiedis! What a pleasure! How can we help you?
I happen to be in the neighborhood, and I need to withdraw some money, and perhaps you could call me a cab?
I'd be happy to, he said. Come, sit down.
He called a cab, and I told him I needed to withdraw a couple of $1,000s, and it was all good. I was sitting there in the middle of the bank thinking, hallelujah, I'm going to be high as a kite in about 45 minutes, when all of a sudden, my radar senses started beeping. I looked up and saw that the same big motherfuckers who had accosted me in the hallway of the hospital were advancing on me from every direction in the bank. Then I looked out the big glass windows and saw uniformed policemen surrounding the building, along with nurses, orderlies, and a friend of mine named Harold who worked as a rehab specialist in the hospital. I vowed that these guys would have to chase me. Once I get into the open street, ain't none of these fuckers gonna catch me, including the cops. I will jump on the back of a bus. I will commandeer a car. I will get on a boat. I will disappear into the bushes. They aren't going to get me. So I jumped out of the chair and went running through the bank, hurtling over anything in my way. I got through a door that led into the office building housing the bank, but as soon as I entered the hall, a whole other contingent of security guards started running toward me. Whoop, can't go that way. I turned to run the other way, and there were more guys advancing on me from that direction. I had nowhere to go, so I just thought, fuck it, and went head to head with these guys. I managed to knock down a few of the building guards and even made my way out into the street, but I was overpowered when one of those huge hospital guards tackled me and got me in such a strong body hold that I thought my liver was going to squeeze out of my ankle bone. I was a weakened little bitch at that point.
Easy, pal, easy, I said. Why do you fuckers care? Just let me go.
No way. Once you escape from lockdown, we're responsible for anything you do, he told me.
He also told me about the hospital employee who'd seen me in the bank and thought it was odd that I was sitting down with the branch manager when I should have been on the ward. When I turned up AWOL, it was the same as escaping a jail, and there was an all-points bulletin out for me, with every cop in the neighborhood searching. They handcuffed me and threw me into a cop car and drove me back to the hospital, where I found out that I had been put into 72-hour lockdown because Bob Forrest had been concerned about our conversation. He had called Lindy, and they got it in their heads that I was suicidal, so they tried to get me committed. The hospital could have ignored them, but they probably thought the last thing they needed was another Kurt Cobain situation on their hands. The whole thing was ludicrous. I never once verbalized anything about killing myself. I never once said I had a gun. All I said in a Jimmy Cagney gangster voice was, "Ah, if I had a heater, I'd shoot my way out of this place right now." Lunatic Bob Forrest, the then king of exaggerations, rumors, and lies, had started the whole ball rolling. And here I was in lockdown. When I got back in, I went straight for the phone and called Eric Greenspan. I want a fucking lawyer to come down here and get me out. I am not suicidal. Get me out of this hospital. Eric promised to help, but he said it might take a little while. In the meantime, I was assigned a room and a 24-hour watchdog at my door. I was already checking out the ceiling ventilation shafts, trying to find a way out, because now my life was getting weirder and uglier by the second. The next day, a nurse came in and told me I would be discharged as soon as the admitting doctor signed my papers. After a few hours, she came back in the room. I was already counting how many balloons of heroin I would cop when she said, "Before you go, there are some people here to see you." That doesn't sound possible. I'm supposed to be discharged? In through the door walked Bob Timmons, followed by a few of my friends and my poor mother, who had flown in from Michigan. I was not at all happy that someone had called my mother and she had to fly out to deal with this mess. I had been ambushed with a full-fledged intervention. We all sat down, and they started to give me the intervention, and I was the sheer disease guy. Everything that came out of my mouth was a lie or a manipulation. Everything I said had an angle so I could position myself to psychologically dominate the scene and get free to go get loaded.
Hey, everything's okay. I'm ready to get better. I just don't want to be in rehab. I've been through this. And of course I'm going to go and get involved in my recovery and yada yada. I conned them into thinking that I was going to get out of there and go to work on being a sober guy. I had no intention of it whatsoever, but I told them everything they wanted to hear just to get out of that hospital. We left the hospital, and most of us went to break bread over my new beginning, which I knew was neither new nor a beginning. Everyone started eating, but I was nibbling and picking and pushing my food around. Okay, I'm going to leave now and go home and get my recovery notebooks. And then I'm going to meet up with Mom and fly home with her tomorrow and go back to the basics and work on my recovery. Really? You're going by yourself? Why don't I come with you? My friend Chris said. I insisted on going alone. I scrammed, got my motorcycle, got some money, picked up some drugs, and checked into the Bonaventure Hotel, a big, modern, fancy hotel in downtown Los Angeles. It had been close to a week since I'd been loaded, so I was chomping at the bit. Right off the bat, I got crazy high, and a bad idea light bulb went off above my head. I got back on the bike and drove to the Chevy dealer by USC to buy a new car. My twisted logic was that even though I had just ditched my intervention posse, I was going to buy a car and then drive around with no destination in mind and get better. I got to the dealership just as they were closing. Wait, I need to buy a car. Give me the best big black Chevy you have. They were all looking skeptically at this crazy high guy who came off the street, but then I whipped out my Amex card, they checked it out, and they had a major attitude adjustment. They brought me a nice Chevy Tahoe and were more than happy to follow me back to the Bonaventure and deliver it. The next morning, I decided it was time to hit the road, so I left my motorcycle in the hotel parking lot, jumped into this brand new Chevy SUV, and started heading east. I was thinking of driving to Colorado or the Dakotas, but I only got as far as East LA. I just wasn't feeling right. So I checked into a motel, got high, and realized that doing some long-distance driving might not be such a good idea. I drove back to Beverly Hills and checked into a hotel on Robertson and did all my drugs. I was at the point where I wasn't even getting high. I was just wide awake, raw, empty, lonely, tired, angry, confused, and terrified of having to deal with the latest mess I'd made. I decided that maybe I should go back to Michigan with my mom. I called her hotel, but she had left town that morning, furious that I had lied to her. I got in my new Tahoe and drove to the airport. I found a payphone and called Lindy to apologize. When I was in Exodus, frantically trying to get out of the locked ward, I had called Lindy and trashed him. I flew to Michigan and did the country house mom hang, trying to get it together one more time. This was a new bottom for me. I'd been institutionalized in a mental ward, escaped, gotten caught, had an intervention, escaped the interventionees, freaked out, bought a car thinking I'd go cross-country, pumped a bunch of drugs into my system and didn't even get high, and now I was back on my mother's couch, shivering through another withdrawal. I felt so bad that my mom had to deal with one more emotional firestorm. Less than 2 months earlier, she had buried her soulmate, and now she had this weak little scarecrow to contend with. But moms are resilient, and she looked at the bright side. I was alive, and prepared to go to battle for myself one more time. There was something to be grateful for when we went over to Steve's grandfather's house for a huge Thanksgiving dinner. I helped myself to some turkey, which was the first meat I'd eaten in a long time. Hey, if I can shoot dope and smoke crack and gobble pills, I can eat a damn plate of turkey and not worry about it. Chapter 13. Nothing. Flea calls 1997 the year of nothing because the Red Hot Chili Peppers played only one concert that year, a festival in July, and even that show got derailed two-thirds of the way through by a typhoon. But for me, 1997 was a year jammed full of adventure and misadventure, strides forward and many steps backward, another year in my topsy-turvy Jekyll and Hyde existence. The year began on a positive enough note. I was in New Zealand, setting up my new house. I remember being in Auckland on New Year's Eve and seeing amateur party people on the streets doing cocaine and champagne. It looked so appalling to me. I was glad I wasn't in that place.
The truth of the matter was that there probably wasn't enough cocaine in a small country like that to keep me satisfied for any length of time. I didn't have any band obligations at this point. One Hot Minute hadn't sold well, especially compared to Blood Sugar, so we had cut back on the touring cycle. Since I was already in New Zealand, I had planned to take a month off and explore India. I went to Puttaparthi for a week, then to New Delhi, but the highlight of my whole trip was the spontaneous trek I made to Dharamsala to see the Dalai Lama. I took a train to Rishikesh and then hired a driver to drive through the Himalayas. Dharamsala seemed to be in a different world, carved out of the mountains, with dirt roads and wooden sidewalks, like an old western town. I got a room and then walked into town. I ate at a delicious vegetarian restaurant and then browsed some shops and bought some tonkas. The town was filled with all these bald monks wearing saffron-colored robes. The next morning, I got up and walked over to the Dalai Lama's temple. I found the office and approached one of the monks who worked there. "Could you please inform the Dalai Lama that Anthony Kiedis is here? I know he must be busy, but I'd like to say hi to him," I said. All of the people in the office started laughing hysterically. "Sir, do you realize what you just said?" one of them replied. "Half of planet Earth is in line to say hello to Dalai Lama. How do you think you can just come in here and see him? His schedule is booked for the next 3 years." He went on and on, telling me all the pressing issues that Dalai Lama had to deal with and how he was the busiest man on the planet. "Okay, I understand. Just leave him a note that Anthony Kiedis says hello. I just wanted to make some contact," I said. They promised to tell him and then started laughing again. I walked away a little disheartened, thinking, oh well, came a long way to meet the Wizard of Oz, but I guess I won't. Such is life. It was a 5-minute walk to my hotel, and when I got back, the lady at the front desk seemed excited.
"Oh, Mr. Kiedis, come here right away. You have a message from the office of the Dalai Lama. This is amazing. They insist that you be there tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.
I got up bright and early the next morning and made it over to the office. "This is how things will go," they lectured me. "First of all, you go through the metal detector. Then you must leave your backpack behind. We have to have these security measures because we are constantly getting death threats from the Chinese. Then you will stand in the corner of the courtyard, where Dalai Lama will be walking down the path with his security en route to his class. Maybe, as he is walking, he might wave to you. You never know. Don't expect him to, but maybe he will." I dutifully went through the metal detector and handed over my backpack and my camera. I took my assigned spot in the corner, and lo and behold, here came the Dalai Lama over the crest with his security posse surrounding him. He looked up and saw me, and his eyes lit up, and a big smile crossed his face. He veered off his path and came straight to me. I was shocked, hoping for a wink, and here he was jogging right over. He cupped my hand in his hands and looked me in the eye. "Anthony, welcome to India. What inspired you to come all the way over here?"
"I just wanted to see the country," I said.
"Isn't India an amazing place? Tell me about your journey. What have you been doing while you've been here?" I gave him a rundown of my itinerary. "Isn't it all amazing? The smells and the colors everywhere you go. Where's your camera? We have to get a picture of you and me."
"They took everything when I came in," I said.
"Go get his camera, for goodness sake," he yelled to one of his aides. "What are you thinking? He needs the camera."
The aide came back with my shitty little disposable camera. The Dalai Lama smiled.
"Let's take a picture."
The whole time we were talking, he hadn't let go of my hand. It was subtle, and I hadn't noticed it for a while, but he was definitely sending me some of his juice. The aide snapped off a shot.
"Okay, now get a long one. A full body one," he instructed.
We talked a little longer, and then he produced a signed copy of his latest book for me. He gave me the book, a few old Tibetan coins, and a white silk scarf, which he blessed. "Thank you so much for the visit," I said. "If there's anything I can ever do to help your cause, then let me know."
"There is something you can do. If Adam Yoke, of the Beastie Boys, ever calls you to play another festival for us, please make yourself available.
If Adam calls, we'll rock the spot, I promised.
You know I'd love to stay and chat, but all these Tibetan elders are waiting, he said. I have to go and teach an advanced course. Of course, you're